Please ask a blessing with me, brothers. Affirm me, please, with an amen or a hallelujah. Father in the heavens, we appeal to you, please, to let your spirit seize control here. Grant that every right word that I speak penetrate deep into our souls, and grant that every false word falls to the ground unnoticed. We continue to leave this congregational meeting at your feet and asking your participation and guidance in the name and through the blood of Yahshua the Messiah. Amen and hallelujah. Yes, if I continue to drill down through the list of commandments that I'm speaking on, the next one in line is on adultery. Very difficult topic. Brother Jose, are all the other microphones off? Okay, because I want to make sure now. So I'm going to ask you to trust me. I don't like it when people abuse or hijack the meeting for a personal agenda, so I need to put your heart at ease. I ask you to just trust me. I'm going to open by citing an article in Engineering Magazine, article written by Chris Wiltz, managing editor of Design News, 10 of the worst environmental disasters in engineering history. We're only going to look at a small set of those. The larger article's 10 events that have happened in recent history, environmental disasters, man-made disasters. On the night of March 12, 1928, the St. Francis Dam, 40 miles northwest of Los Angeles, failed, creating a disaster that would become the second greatest loss of life in the history of California, the number one being the great earthquake in San Francisco. Once the dam collapsed, 12.4 billion gallons of water roared down the San Francisco Canyon, creating a wall of water 140 feet high that would eventually travel 54 miles, leaving death and devastation in its wake. The disaster claimed 600 lives, and bodies were found as far away as the Mexican border. That's a disaster. That's the date of the article. Another one, on December 2nd, 1984, a leak at a Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal, India, released about 30 tons of toxic gases into the air and created the largest industrial accident in history. The gases flowed into nearby towns, poisoning the populace and killing an estimated 15,000 people over the years. To this day, the area is still contaminated with toxic materials. 400 tons of industrial waste by some estimates. These have created a variety of health issues among the locals. That's a disaster. That is stuff we did, mankind. This is one many of us remember. Arguably the granddaddy of all oil spills, the infamous Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred on March 24, 1989, when the Exxon Valdez, an oil tanker, struck the Bligh Reef in Prince William Sound, Alaska, and spilled an estimated 11 to 38 million gallons, depending on whose estimates you go by, of crude oil into the water. The remote location made cleanup especially daunting, and prior to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the Exxon spill was the largest oil spill in U.S. waters in history. Estimates say that the immediate effects of the spill killed more than 100,000 seabirds, 2,000-plus otters, 300 harbor seals, over 200 bald eagles, and more than a dozen orcas, and an unqualified number of salmon and herring. These are man-made disasters, every one of them. Human beings can look themselves in the mirror and say, I caused that. And now, the ultimate ecological disaster, adultery. This is not a gag. If you met the people I met who've suffered the horrors of adultery, you would agree this is the ultimate ecological disaster. It wounds families, assemblies, communities. Children's hearts are crushed. It is an ecological disaster without comparison. When King David fell to this great sin, it launched a cascade of evil. What David did a little bit, his son did in big ways. Then it was a downward spiral of adultery blended with idolatry, So the whole nation of Israel was split up. What ecological disaster in your environment have you seen because of this horrible, horrible sin? What is adultery? There's other definitions coming, but this is the one I want you to keep in mind. When you have a man and woman who are married, and somebody from the outside steals them. Got a mommy and daddy, husband and wife, somebody from the outside steals them. And for some of you young people, that might be hard to understand, but it's a very evil thing. There was a time in this country when if somebody pulled that stunt, you could take them to court. It was called alienation of my husband's affections or my wife's affections. You could actually sue somebody for breaking up that marriage. The answer is to just say no. And I hope to give to you today some spiritual energy so you can say no when you're confronted with this. Now, I think people around here are pretty well behaved. But I know statistically, those who are within the sound of my voice, either on the outreach or in the media, at least one person out there is probably confronted with this temptation now. My name is Michael Bannock. I live in Fulton, Missouri, but I travel as an engineer. The title of my remarks today is the seventh commandment of 10, adultery. Just say no. We'll cover the command itself, meaning of key words in the command. We'll do some case studies and some strategies going forward to keep ourselves pure. This is a very hard topic to study because it brings back memories of what I've witnessed and observed in my research. I've fallen to all the commandments. I think I've fallen to all the commandments of the 10. I never got into this one. But I talk to people who have. I guarantee you're going to hear some things today you never heard before. You'll be challenged in ways you've never been challenged before. And I can see why people don't normally talk about this behind the microphone. This is hard stuff. In Exodus 20:14, it says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Because it starts with the words, "Thou shalt not," it is traditionally considered a negative command. That is, it's a prohibition. When I say negative, I don't mean it's bad. I'm just saying it's a prohibition against something. Like honor your mother and father is a positive command. You're told to go do something. Here you're told to not to do something. Now, under adultery in dictionary.com, it confirms something I've suspected. I never looked it up until today as material was pulled together. It comes from the Latin word adulterare, to corrupt. And then I looked up adulteration and see the word adulterate means to debase or make impure by adding inferior materials or elements. Use cheaper, inferior, or less desirable goods in the production of anything, like to adulterate food, contaminants. And you can be sure adultery is a contaminant. Comes from a Hebrew word, 5003 Strong's numbers, ne'af, ne'af. Oh, here he pronounces it no'af. And I tried to get to the bottom of this word. I was hoping, like many Hebrew words, you would have some root word underneath that lent clarity to it. And it just simply means adultery. Figuratively, to apostatize, in other words, there's spiritual adultery. But I guess I'm a little uncomfortable because to discover that fornication is wrong, you have to go to other Hebrew scriptures. Well, it turns out the commandment against adultery applies to people who are single anyway, because if you do something while you're single, that is contrary to Yah's will, if you mismanage your moral purity, you are adulterating your marriage in the future. And right now, there's so many people. There was a fellow, one of the young men in England was said to have been weeping. You know, we have brethren in England. He's weeping because he says, "I don't know if I'm going to find a wife who's pure when it's my turn to get married." Because people have been reaching into the future and corrupting the marriage that they're going to have in the future by misbehaving today. Start with a case study, the lady at the hospital and the name on the prayer list. This goes back decades. I was at the Friestown Assembly, in the 1980s for about 5 years. And it was a name on the prayer list every week. Same name. I didn't know who this guy was. Usually you can look at a prayer list and you say, oh, I know that guy, or he's related to somebody I know. A mysterious name on the prayer list. For years it was there. My dear mother had surgery. She pulled through just fine. And as she was recovering in this room, I noticed she had a roommate in the hospital room. You guys know me. I try to make friends with everybody. I make friends with the janitor, the nurses, everybody. So I struck up a conversation with the lady in my mom's hospital room. And this guy walks in and chats with her for a while. He introduced himself. I gave him my name. And they left. I mean, he left. I said, oh, is that your husband? She says, oh, no, that's my boyfriend. He used to be married. I got a lot of criticism for taking him. But, you know, you can't break up a marriage unless it's already got troubles, you know. So in the matter of just a few brief sentences, she's declaring to me that she broke up somebody's marriage and she managed to capture that man for herself. And she justified it. Oh, it's weak. The marriage is weak. There's a lot of insight in that. What you're about to hear, you may not have thought of before. What is the most cited passage in Scripture? People think it's John 3:16, but the one phrase in the Scripture that's quoted most often is the one that says, don't judge me. Don't judge. And every time I heard somebody say that, they're guilty. I never heard of anybody say that. It was innocent. But the fact is that adulterers are judgmental. You cannot get around it. This woman was judging against that man's wife. If one man wants to steal another man's wife, he's got to, in his mind, declare her present husband unworthy of love. By nature, the sin is judgmental. I'm just here on the sidelines, you know. These people are pointing fingers at each other. It's judgmental against the unseen spouse. This gal spoke against a weak marriage. Well, for those of you out there who might be dealing with this, know this, that any piece of trash can break up a weak marriage. That doesn't take anybody special to break up a weak marriage. And a lot of trashy people do break up marriages. A lot of trashy people do steal spouses from others. Let's think about David for a moment. The prophet Nathan came to him with a story, a made-up story about a man who wanted to feed a visitor. And this rich man, instead of going to his own cattle and butchering them, he goes to the home of a poor man and steals a lamb that he treasures. And he brings his lamb and he cuts it up and he cooks it and he gives it to his visitor. And when David hears this story, what does he say? He says, that man should die. The guilt inside comes roaring out in judgmentalism. And you know the law does not allow for a capital punishment, killing somebody for stealing. When you steal in the Torah, you're supposed to pay back what you stole plus some extra, depending on the crime. The fact that he says, that guy should die, that's a tip-off that he's got guilt inside that he hasn't gotten over. Now, when Nathan says, you're the man, it was all a symbol. Now, at least David immediately repented. Boy, the weight of guilt he must have been carrying. How could he go to services every week? But again, it's evidence that adulterers are judgmental. You don't want to go there. They must judge against the unseen spouse as unworthy of fidelity. I'm not being judgmental, they are. I don't know how they could stand before heaven. Talk about the budding minister and his wife. Let's see, I didn't prep this one like I wanted. This one goes back in time. Oh, by the way, that name on the prayer list, I don't know if I made this clear. That was the guy who came to the hospital room. That name on the prayer list was the guy who came to the hospital room. It took me like a week to put all that together. So wait a minute, that guy introduced himself. I know that name. Because, you know, we're all looking at the prayer list regularly. And not too many people here who were back in the old days, but For those of you who remember the old days, the gal who put that name on the prayer list was the one who worked at the truck stop. Maybe you know who I'm talking about. Yeah. Beloved sister. At least she loved her fellow man enough to put his name on the prayer list. Approximately 20 years ago, my mother was was regressing with Alzheimer's, and she was just sort of stuck at the, her regression stopped, and she was like at a six-year-old level, like a little girl. And, you know, it's funny, when they get past a certain point, they're actually easy to take care of, believe it or not. Well, I met a guy, I took a chance, I made friends outside the network, and this guy was talking a real good game about marriage, the sanctity of marriage, and him and his wife believed how holy marriage is. And they had this ministry of helping people. They loved to help people. But he was not an ordained minister. He insisted that he was. He had people that worshipped with him, and he bragged about his wife's good behavior as evidence of his ministerial prowess. He lived in Alabama, and there was an engineering company near where he lived, and they made a product that very few people in the world know how to make. Maybe you've heard of T1 lines. Well, this product is connected to T1 lines. And there's very few engineers who know how to work on that stuff, and I was one of them. And I thought, I could move down there. I know they'll hire me. It's hard to get engineers to move to Huntsville, Alabama. And I can move down there, and I could pay them to take care of my mom. And we actually talked about this. A lot of you don't know about this. And I visited him one weekend down there. He started talking about the heart, trusting your heart, following your heart. I said, I don't know what you're talking about, man. And that's not my theology. Weeks later, he left his wife. He left his wife for another married woman. He took a married woman from her husband. She took him from the wife he had. And he insisted that this relationship was of heaven. Now, this guy has been kicked out of the fellowship. I remember I worked at a phone company then. I had the ability to set up multiple calls on one phone. I used my calling card, you know, but all these calls, a massive interstate teleconference. This guy insisted that what he was doing was right. I said, why are you being so mean to your real wife? Why are you doing this? He said, she's a wicked woman. I said, well, that's funny. You told me her good behavior was evidence of your ministerial prowess. Well, now you're condemning her. Her only fault is she would not allow multiple wives. That's her only fault. He insisted this was from heaven. He absolutely insisted on it. So anyway, we got multiple witnesses on all aspects of this. The guy was kicked out of the fellowship, not by a formal body of elders, but by leading members of the fellowship nationwide. And he hasn't been heard from since. But this is the deceitfulness of sin. Those of you who are toying with this idea, condemning somebody else, setting up something in your mind, it's all a big stinking lie. We all know it, and you know it. Adulterers think they are approved of heaven. In Hebrews 3:13, it says, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Let's talk about David Wilkerson, a remarkable report from him. Now, a little bit about David Wilkerson. I can't resist. How many have never heard of David Wilkerson? Okay, so I don't want to waste people's time. So, okay. David Wilkerson had the most successful anti-drug campaign in the nation. Those of you who lived in Pennsylvania, again, you know, it was just down the road, Teen Challenge. It has been said that when Bill Bennett, the drug czar operating under President Reagan, he went around the country looking for drug programs that the government could fund. He came across Teen Challenge. He said, this is it. You guys have the best batting average of anybody in the world. A Teen Challenge, right there in Little Pennsylvania, just down the road from where I lived. And David Wilkerson said, no, I don't want your money, because if I take money from you, you're going to tell me what to do with the money. We're going to keep right on with the success we have. And now, he's the real deal. David Wilkerson is the real deal. But he did believe that he was a prophet sent to America. And some of his writings get kind of intense. Whether you accept his his visions or not. I don't think they were visions. I think they were things that he felt strongly about. Primarily, he addressed back in the 80s with this book, Set the Trumpet to Thy Mouth. He was telling the nation, you're going to be judged for the immorality in the culture and the immorality in the churches. So he was kind of ahead of his time there. But he made an interesting observation. I quote, I have yet to meet an adulterer who was not convinced their relationship was more spiritual than physical. Some pray and read their Bibles together. Now, this quote was lifted from an excerpt that I could capture from Amazon.com. I own that book, and if I could find it, it's a collector's item. On Amazon, the original paperback's going for about $45. It's a little bitty paperback. One of the ladies at the Friestown Assembly gave it to me years ago. The reason this stuck in my mind, this fact, this bizarre fact, is that I read something virtually identical in a book I had at the time on Christian counseling. I was not interested in Christian counseling. I just happened to have this book somehow in my possession, and I was just thumbing through it. And they said, when people fall to moral impurity in a congregational setting, they often think the Almighty's with them. Oh, we prayed together. We sang songs together. We caused each other to go deeper in our spiritual walk. This is the deceitfulness of sin. I'm not making these things up. I'm warning you of these things because when temptation comes whistling your way, I want you to know of the devil's tricks. I personally have interviewed at least three people who have fallen to this sin. You know, it isn't like I write it all down and keep it in my back pocket. I can only remember three. It was probably been more. But I would discreetly go to them and ask them about this stuff. I remember asking one of them many years after he recovered from a terrible fall, a terrible scandal in his life. And I says, is it true that when people are in that situation, they think they're doing the right thing? And his response was so intense. It was visceral. It was like something deep inside. He just screamed through the phone, it's very deceitful, it's very deceitful, it's very deceitful. And you think when you're in it, you're on some moral high ground. I got to believe most of us don't know what this is like, right? I got to believe everybody here has like never gotten into this. For normal people, average people like you and me, this seems very bizarre. But this is a reality. You think, in that mess, you think, this is okay. Oh, this will work out. Oh, yeah, we're on a moral high ground. His laws don't apply to us. We have some special angle. Then add to this, you know, my own interviews. How about celebrities like Amy Grant, who openly dumped her husband for another man? The LORD wants me happy, she insisted. Has anybody ever thought about suffering for righteousness' sake? How about the observation of David Wilkerson and others who have seen this deception at play? Then there's Sister Jezebel. I put sister, the word sister, in scare quotes. The book of Revelation does not call her Sister Jezebel, but you can be sure that's what they called her. She's in one of those assemblies in the book of Revelation, and Yahshua describes her sins very graphically. There's the temple prostitutes of paganism, and things like that. I'm being careful and discreet because of the mixed audience, and, you know, it's just a hard topic to cover. But I could stand up here all day long and give you case study after case study of people who have blended religion with moral impurity. I don't know if this is the best place to inject it now, but this is related to other material I've given you, where young people fall in love, and the intensity of the feelings is so strong, they assume the Almighty's with them. Oh, yeah, he told us we belong together. And the parents are saying, no, it'll never work. The kids go on and make a mess of their lives, despite the counsel of their parents. This whole boy meets girl thing is very deceiving. I'm sorry, I misspelled deceitful there. The conclusion is this sin of moral impurity is most deceitful, very deceitful. I'm going to read a passage from 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7 through 13. Neither be ye idolaters, as some were of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt the Messiah, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all of these things happen unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he stand, taketh heed lest he fall. Don't think, oh, that'll never happen to me. Oh, no. Well, I've heard that before. I've heard that before. That isn't the answer. To just say, oh, no, that'll never happen to me. You should assume that the devil's going to come after, if he's going to come after the holiest man of his age, which was David, what makes you think you're going to escape this? There hath no temptation taken you, continuing, but such as is common to man. Those of you who are contemplating marriage or newlyweds, has anybody bothered to tell you that outside attraction is a fact of life? Anybody told you about that? That you're supposed to anticipate that and protect your mind and your heart? Has anybody told you that? Outside attraction is pretty common. But Elohim is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. There's so many aspects of this. I'm just going to talk about certain things, hoping I touch a nerve. Strategies for preventing this sin. Strategy number zero. It's so primary and plenary, I make it strategy zero. Anybody can form an emotional attachment to another. You've got to be careful. Now, here's an example from the workplace with me. I'm going to be very cryptic here because I never know who's watching. But I was in an engineering environment once working with a lady who I did not find her attractive. Okay, I don't think the average person would find her attractive. But just working side by side with her, I found myself drawn to her. So I'm scratching my head thinking, well, I read about this. I knew in advance things like this happened. The problem is, by the way, that lady was married. And so I had to be real careful how I behaved toward her, real careful what I said. I care about her and her life and her family more than any feelings I have. This can happen to anybody. We are not to follow our hearts. We're supposed to guard our hearts. It is possible to like something too much. I'll put it to you this way. If following your heart and your happiness was all you had to do, we would not need the Bible. We'd just pray three words. Just every Sabbath, we come in and say, follow your heart. Let's adjourn and eat. Just follow your heart. Go ahead. Follow your heart. That's probably among all the glib statements of advice I've ever heard, that's probably the most satanic. Follow your heart. Joshua tells us that it's out of the heart proceedeth adulteries, idolatries, murders, covetousness, all these things. We're supposed to guard our heart. Number 1539 talks about the law of the tassels. This is the law about the fringe, where they were putting some kind of blue reminder on the hem of their garments. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of Yahweh and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you used to go a-whoring. Please think about that for a moment. You follow not your own heart and your own eyes, after which you used to go a-whoring. In other words, when you follow your eyes and your heart, you are whoring. It's right there. Ooh, I like this. Ooh, I like that. And it's not in the notes, but I remember in Luke 16, the Pharisees who were covetous were deriding Yahshua. And he said, you are they which justify yourselves before men. But Elohim knows your heart. For that which is highly esteemed in the eyes of men is abomination in the eyes of Yahweh. What are we going to do with this culture that's so corrupt? Appealing to our hearts, appealing to our eyes, appealing to our emotions. No, recognize you're vulnerable and you're in a very dangerous place. This world is a very dangerous place, morally. Strategy number one, improper touching, such as touching the feet, pinching. 1 Corinthians 7:1, it says, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." I was trying to get a grip on that word touch. Turns out there's two or three words for touch in Greek. In the Greek scriptures we have, only touch upon two of them. There's a word, Greek number 680, haptomahi, which is used in this verse. And it comes up in all these instances, like where people want to touch Yahshua to get healed, or he touches the children to bless them. And that's the word Paul uses here. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. Or are there other kinds of touch? And only once could I find a use for a word prospasau, and it comes from a plain word, pasau, meaning to touch, to lay a finger on. I'm sorry, it comes from a root, pasau, meaning to touch. I had to look that up on a Greek dictionary, and it's like just a basic word for touching. When Yahshua said, "You lay heavy burdens on the people, you lawyers, but you don't lift a finger to help them," it uses that word there, prospasau. One of the reasons I have difficulty getting closure on that word touch in this passage is because in the Hebrew culture, men don't go around touching women. People don't go around touching each other. They just don't do that. In this culture, they do it. But it's just, you're not supposed to do that. That first word there for touch, haptomahi, appears to have some intensity involved with it. Whatever Paul is getting at here, it's evident that he's urging caution and restraint. And that's why I'm very careful how I touch you, sisters. You girls know I love you more than I could say. You know I celebrate your station in the world, in the fellowship. You're here to bring beauty, order, and love to this world. You can, in an honest moment, ask the men. We'll tell you, if there were no ladies in this world, Gehenna would look attractive. We need you girls. That doesn't give me license to pinch you or to grab you by the foot or some other improper kind of touch. Paul is urging caution and restraint, and I'd urge that upon you. Don't borrow from the future. I feel sorry for people who have experimented with improper affection. I have evidence that later in life their hearts cry out for intimacy and they never get it. Why would we borrow from the future? In Ecclesiastes 3:5, it says there's a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. For newcomers, or anyone else for that matter, if anyone expresses a concern about a handshake or any gesture, this is a rule to follow. I'm not establishing doctrine, but I'm urging upon you that if anybody here goes too far with a hug or a touch, any gesture, and the other person says, "I'm not comfortable with that," I beg you, for your own salvation, for the unity of the fellowship, back off. Don't go justifying yourself and saying, "Oh, I was only trying to save you. No, just back off and say, "I'm sorry. I was out of order." Even if the accusation's false, say, "I'm sorry. I was out of order. I'll be careful next time." Be humble about it. That way, Yahweh will give you grace. Avoid conversation starters that make you feel good. I'm going to tell you what I'm talking about here, but I didn't even want to put it on the screen. Conversation starters that make you feel good. I'm not smart enough to think of this stuff. I heard this on the radio from a marriage counselor. He said that, I prayed before the presentation. I'm just going to have to leave it in Yahweh's hands. But he said that in the workplace, just about the stupidest thing you could do is go to someone of the opposite gender and say, "You know, I really like you. I have a hard time getting you out of my mind." Why would anybody say that? Because they want a response. Somebody in the sound of my voice may be tempted to say that at work next week. Don't even think of it. I tell you, there's no disaster greater in our environment than adultery and the evils and the devastation it causes. And the people come out of it every time. They say, I knew the moment I started acting that way, it wasn't going to turn out good, but I did it anyway. And this old game where they say, I'm going to take the plunge now and look for grace later. Others found mercy, I can too. Friends, it never works that way. It just doesn't. Everybody who passes through the fires of this great sin, they come back and say, don't do it. It's horrible. Don't do it. Don't start it. Don't start conversations that make you feel good. Strategy number three. I mean, I can't be comprehensive, but after a while you could see the spirit of what I'm commending to you. Number three, do not provide counsel across gender boundaries. Let the women minister with the women and the men with the men. One of the most legendary scripts that are out there in the world of religion is where a frustrated wife comes to a minister and starts telling the minister about how bad her husband is. And we guys are suckers for this. We you know, our hearts will open with compassion. And, you know, compassion, the emotions and the chemicals in your bloodstream for compassion have a lot of overlap with the chemicals for romantic love. And there's so many men who have fallen to this. And this frustrated wife is looking to the strength and gentleness of the minister. Before you know it, she's admiring him too much. You ministers are no exception. If a male minister must get involved, his wife must be there as part of the conversation. That's why I respect the ministry, but I respect the wives double and triple. I don't know how you girls put up with all. I think of all the crazy things that the minister's wives get pulled into. Even the briefest discussion must be immediately halted until a better situation can be framed up. You say, hold it, let's talk about this with my wife here. This stuff, this is a sidebar, but in classical Christian counseling, they tell an executive, when you hire a secretary, your wife must approve of her. That's very old-fashioned, but it's very wise. Because, men, your wives are terrific, have terrific radar for women with false intentions, wrong motives. And your wives will pick up on that stuff right away and say, don't hire her. She's going to be trouble. Well, I'm adding also the golden rule of counseling. When someone asks, I need for you to keep this conversation confidential, you must respond, I cannot guarantee that. I can only assure you that I will not discuss this with someone unless they are part of the problem or the solution. I hate that when people tell me a secret and then they go, oh, by the way, this is private. And I pretty much say something like that to them every time. So this is a fine time to tell me something a secret. Well, this business of counseling is it's a trap of the devil, because you might be flattered. Oh, she wants to ask my advice. Oh, he's coming to me. I want to be a friend. We've been friends a long time. Surely he can come to me. When you make a marriage covenant, you understand part of that agreement is you've got to forsake all others. And as friendships with people of the opposite gender, you've got to tone that down. Strategy number four, keep everything in the open. In John 3:19-21, I should memorize this passage. I like it so much. This verse really reveals our hearts. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world. And men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in Yahweh. Examples, watch out for private conversations between men and women. If you cannot discuss it in the sanctuary with people nearby who might see you in the distance, why not? Maybe you have a good reason, I don't know. But you should ask yourself, why do I feel a need to be in private on this? You know? Those of you who know me well know that whenever I correspond with a married sister by email, I'll courtesy copy her husband. Everything out in the open. There's no reason for me to have a secret email message with any of the sisters. That's absurd. By the way, I just learned about a trap in Facebook. There's a messaging chain in there. In the back, you can do messages. And I just realized, well, I could converse with a sister there and nobody see it. So I'm thinking of doing something like on the open boards so everybody could see it. If it's something really red hot and critical, maybe we should make a three-way call with the husband and wife and me. I mean, there's no reason for me to have a secret conversation with any married sister here, or any sister, actually. A married girl. I mean, what? All I have to do is put myself in your husband's shoes. Ask permission of spouses before engaging a married person in a project. Don't even mention it till you get clearance. For example, I'd never go to one of the married sisters and say, hey, I want to sing this song with you. And then she says, good, let's sing it. And then I go, now I'll check with your husband. No. That's B before A. I always go to the husbands first and say, hey, can I sing with your wife? You know, or other projects that have come along. You know, girls, you want intimacy. You do. The book of Hosea, Yahweh says that we're going to call him Aishi, my man, which is a revolutionary idea where we own him as much as he owns us. And it's a good thing that the married men and women are watching over each other's hearts and souls. That's a good thing. Strategy number 5, if a person comes on to you in the wrong spirit, warn them to stop or you will tell their spouse. I'm not comfortable with flirtatious talk like that. If it continues, I normally advise your wife or husband. Something. Practice your own words. You have to be real careful here, because sometimes people can be flirtatious in a way where if you say they're being flirtatious, they have a way out and say, no, I wasn't being flirtatious. But we should be practicing these words of life and strength. This middle paragraph, I didn't rewrite it as I should. But if someone comes on, if I was to have a conversation with someone, and a lady, and she said to me, I'm not comfortable with where this conversation is going, I would just say, I'm sorry. I was out of order. I never meant any harm. I'm so sorry. Just back off. Don't try to justify yourself. I'd like us to develop relationships of trust because when hard times come, we're going to have to hang together. I don't know if the end is coming just yet, but I know hard times are coming. We better be able to trust each other. Number 6, you must tap the brake in any conversation where a person complains about their spouse across gender boundaries. Very uncomfortable when women complain about their husbands into my ears. Now, if the situation is that bad, there are back channels for resolution. I remember experiencing this in the workplace years ago. It was a very uncomfortable thing for a woman to complain about her husband to me. But anyway, in the assembly, if a woman's really struggling with a difficulty in her marriage, she can go to the sisters. One of those sisters will be married, and then through her husband, we can get a back channel and create a chain of counsel or something. But somebody calls you on that, say, hey, I'm not comfortable with you complaining about your spouse. You know, you're supposed to say, no, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I know that frustrating situations emerge. I know that. And you're going to be tempted to recruit the sympathies of people you admire, people you trust. But there are other avenues, and as the scriptures promise, he makes a way of escape. Here's another strategy. Love. Dedication to the welfare of others. Remember David's experience with Nathan. Nathan came to him and described a symbolic story. He talks about a poor man who loved this lamb and a rich man who took the lamb. Do you remember why he took the lamb? He took that lamb because he had a visitor. There's a lot of spiritual insight in that symbolic story. When these temptations come, they are visitors. They're visitors. They're not going to stay around long. In fact, you ought to show them the door. They're visitors. Let's take a moment now and talk about the stepfather I never had. You talk about dedication to the welfare of others. Now, there's nothing in here that will embarrass you or offend you. I've carefully selected the words I use to describe this. My poor mom had been through three marriages. When she was first married, on her 17th birthday, it was the first day of her life she could get married without a guardian's approval. My mom was an orphan. Her parents had died in an accident. And poor girl married a man twice her age. That did not work out. And she then went through two more husbands. My father was her second husband. My stepfather was, he was a criminal. I don't know how else to say it. He was just a criminal. And my mother was just crushed by all that. And as my mother was recovering from all that, I'd say about 3 years after that, last marriage, my mom was so burned out. And then she met a wonderful man named Norman. It's kind of funny because at that point in history, there was a popular song, Norman, on the radio. Maybe some of you remember that song. I don't know. We thought it was kind of cute. Mom was going with a guy named Norman, and his name was on the radio. A very clean relationship. I remember on Saturday, this is long ago now, but I remember on Saturday afternoon seeing Norman walk down the sidewalk in the summer. He had two giant brown bags with him, filled with soda, pretzels, beer. The beer was for, you know, him and Mom, and the pretzels and potato chips and the soda pop was for me and my sisters. We liked it when Norman came around. We had a lot of fun. For them, a good date was just watching TV on the couch. Now, they did go out on occasion, but it was a simple and pure dating relationship. I remember one Saturday night, Norman came, and the faucet was leaky, and I showed it to him. And I said, you know, I can get it to stop leaking by wrapping a hammer on it. I'm just a kid, you know. And he scolded me. He says, you never hit something with a hammer. I wanted to sass back, but I figured, that ain't worth it. You know, he's bigger than me. Norm was a good guy. One memorable episode is when they went out to get paint, wall paint, and the can wasn't sealed properly, and his beautiful jacket, it was a nice fancy windbreaker, was stained with all that paint. And he never complained a little bit. Now, this was before the age of latex paints. Those stains are not going to go away. And Mom always remarked how Norm never got angry about that. She found a real gem. But then Norm stopped coming around. Now, I was a kid. I didn't take note of it. It isn't like I was keeping track of when Norm came around. They just stopped coming around. And as it got into the autumn, there was one cold Sunday night. I think I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show. And I'm a young boy just laying on the floor of the living room watching the Ed Sullivan Show. A doorbell rings, and I answer, and it's Norm. And a thin lady, kind of petite, he had her hair cut like a pixie. And they had a giant bouquet between them. I didn't know what this meant, but I called Mom. I said, hey, Norm is out the front door with some lady. And I went back to watching TV, and Mom talked with him in the vestibule. She brought the giant bouquet. That's a huge bunch of flowers. She brought it into the home. And I never saw Norm again after that. Only years later did I find out what happened. Norm had been separated from his wife. And my mom said to him, this ain't going to fly. That's recent slang. She said, this ain't going to work. This isn't going to happen, you and me. You go back to your wife and you make things right. You go back to your wife and you patch that thing up and make it work. You do the right thing. See, my mom had been through three disasters. She knows the pain of a broken marriage. I've talked to people who've initiated the divorce, and even they're unhappy. My mom did the right thing. She said, no, you go back there and you rebuild with her. See, when they came, when he came to the door that night with that lady, that was his wife. They were thanking my mom for pushing them back together. Now, my mom belonged to a branch of Christianity that we would say is got a lot of wrong things in it, a lot of pagan influences in there. But it's written, they who do what is in the Torah by nature without having the Torah are a Torah unto themselves. Now think about it. Those of you in the sound of my voice, you know more about Yahweh's law than my mom did. If my dear mom could find the strength to turn away a man she really, really liked a lot, surely you guys can do it. Surely you can say no. Norm would have made a great stepfather, but for the sake of the kingdom and for the sake of righteousness, I'm glad they didn't link up. I'm really glad they didn't. Before my mother succumbed to Alzheimer's, we were living in Frystown, and she really took a liking to the Wilson family and some of the other brethren who come by. Their love and the light they showed. My mother turned to me just before she went under with the Alzheimer's. She said, Michael, I think I'd like to be in your religion. And I said, Mom, do you believe Yahshua rose from the dead, walked out of his own grave? She says, oh, yeah, I believe that. Given Mom's condition, I saw no occasion for discipleship. But it is my hope that Yahweh takes this into account. But she did the hard thing. The ultimate messianic ethic. And there were great multitudes with him. Luke 14, verse 25 to 27. And he turned and said unto them, if any man come to me and hate not his father and his mother and his wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, even his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his gallows and come after me cannot be my disciple. Well, friends, they may not let me preach here at YRM much more, because this is going to be a main theme for me for the rest of my life. Now, I use the word gallows. Most Bibles say cross, but we know better. Gallows, an instrument of open execution. What are your gallows? Maybe you've got an attachment to somebody you should not be with. Before you pull the trigger and make a mess, you're better off carrying your gallows. In Luke 9, 23 to 24, and he said to them all, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his gallows daily. Daily. And follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it. The messianic call is a call to die. This is not some sick, deranged suicide pact. In the book of John, he says his words are spirit. And even though if we interpret them spiritually, the intensity of this call to deny the self, to die to the self, there must be some practical application that's painful. In romance music and movies, the lovers feel like they will, quote, die if they can't have each other. What makes you think suffering for righteousness' sake won't be painful? In 1 Peter 3:14, it says, But and if you suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are you. Who's willing to suffer for righteousness' sake? Paul says, in one place, that I may know him, and the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable to his death. In another place, he says, you are dead, and your life is hidden with Messiah and Elohim. In yet another place, Paul says, I die daily. In yet another place, Paul says, for Messiah, we are the smell of death to the world around us, because we don't want to rip and run and play like they do. Let's get something straight, friends. This is, for me, this is where the real fun is. When we have board games, volleyball, rip and run at the feast, horseback riding, I have good, clean fun with you guys. And I don't have to be afraid of a dirty joke or somebody doing something sneaky. This really is the kingdom amongst us. But the entry ticket is to die to yourself. There's things you got to leave behind. And then you're free to have a really big time. When we emerge from the waters of baptism with a new life, that new life is undeserved. Our entire mentality must be reoriented to the mind of Messiah. The only way to cope with this high calling is to lower our expectations. You may feel, Sammy, we got problems sometimes emerging right at the waters of baptism. People come out of there, and they want this, and they want that. They want prosperity. They want a wife. Some guys want multiple wives. Remember, I've been in the faith many years, and I've been around, and I've seen what goes on. People, some guys, after baptism, they want to be a leader. They want to be some want to be called rabbi. Some want their rights. Some want to start a political movement. In Matthew 11, at the very end of the chapter, Yahshua says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." I don't know what burdens you're bringing here today into the assembly hall, those who are listening today. Let it go. Let it go. If it's some boy meets girl thing, let it go. There are many people who have emerged from the waters of baptism, and they go right to Yahweh with a demand. They want this, they want that. I want prosperity, this and that. And the unhappiest people I know are those who have not taken Yahshua's yoke upon them. To be meek and lowly in heart, unassuming, undemanding. Let his blessings flow into you. This is the only way to successfully endure temptation as we walk through the narrow gate. And that is the way to peace. That is the way to his serenity. Meek and lowly heart, unassuming. Adultery, just say no. Please don't bring, Brother Giovanni, are you within reach here? Because I'm wrapping up, brother. Yahweh will make a way of escape for you if you're being faced with this. And I love every one of you. And I pray that my actions are always honorable before you. Okay?